This week, Wexford County Council withdrew the blue flag from Coretown Beach, one of the county's most popular destinations. The reason? The beach is no longer there. The famous golden sand was washed away in a series of recent storms. Coastal erosion is a serious problem in many areas, and I visited Coretown on a very windy evening last night with Green MEP Grace O'Sullivan.
Grace, we've come to Coretown Beach. There's hardly any sand here.
It's quite remarkable. It's extremely windy today, but you can see the sand has been just eroded away, and it is shocking for the people living here in Coretown to see how their beach has been, literally their sandy beach, their glorious sandy beach has been destroyed. And this, Fergal, is really just a sign of the times. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We know the climate's changing. We know sea level is rising globally. That means around the world and around Ireland. And when you think about it, 40% of the Irish people live within 5 kilometres of the coastline. And people like myself from Tramore, like I've been looking at the erosion on the beaches around Tramore for the last number of years. You've seen full rock faces eroding away. We're seeing beaches eroding away. And you know, we just have to kind of recognise that because of climate change, sea level is rising, and the impact of that is exactly what we see here in Coretown today. The sand and the beach has simply eroded away. But not only that, Fergal, sometimes the local authorities are carrying out some works. Like, for instance, I'm aware here in Coretown where the pier here,
just behind us here,
that there was some construction work done and some hard boulders were put in along the coast here. You'll see further up as well. Hard armouring, they call it. And you know what? There was critique to that, the planning on that. And people like Karen Dubsky of Coastwatch really let the authorities know that this wasn't the type of action that was required, that there was other engineering mechanisms that might have actually solved the problem that we're seeing here today with the sand being eroded away.
Let's just describe the problem here, okay? A couple of hundred yards down here, there's an outcrop of rocks. They were always there. Then you come along, there's just more rocks, and then it's all stone with a tiny little bit of sand left.
Yeah, that's right. So what you have, you see the rock face is exposed. And I mean, that's quite dangerous for anyone who would want to use the water here, tourists or locals who'd want to go swimming. I mean, I certainly wouldn't swim there now with that kind of rock exposure.
And that used to be covered.
And that was all covered with sand, you know. So, and you can see that, like, we're standing quite high up here. You can see there, it's a metre and a half above the lower area. So
okay,
that would
so
indicate
all of that is gone. We're standing, it's almost a dune.
Yeah, that's right. It looks like a dune,
drop,
but the whole drop, and that, if I'm just looking roughly, I'd say you're talking about 2 metres there of a drop. Again, it makes the whole beach dangerous for children. You know, so
you wouldn't allow your child to go swimming here now. It drops off very, very steeply.
Oh, I wouldn't let a child go in here at all. So you can see, so we're looking at three, almost like three gradients here. So where we're standing is nearly 2 metres above the next level. And then you go for about 8 or 9 metres, and then you can see it again dropping down. So it wouldn't be safe to swim here now by any means. So this, you know, it is an indication. Like I said, 40% of the Irish people are living along the shore. Most people of my age, my generation, we've been seeing it happening. Global warming is happening, the sea level is rising, and how we can measure that is what we're seeing here today is the full beaches changing and full coastal areas changing. And what we are calling for in the Green Party is that we have a national coastal strategy for the whole of Ireland. And then instead of this piecemeal little bits of work here and there, that we look at this as something that we have to think long term. And that's where, with climate change, we have to think long term. And we need in Ireland now, we really do need a coastal strategy so that we can have a national plan instead of piecemeal actions.
when you mention piecemeal things, erosion has been a feature of this coast for a couple of years. I mean, if we look up there, we can probably see a Gorey, Brittas. Beyond there, there's been erosion as well.
That's right. And you know, kind of what breaks my heart is when I see some of the mitigation that the local authorities
are
doing.
People are putting in rocks. You can see it over here.
And they're putting in rocks. And, you know, it's a pity because...
It doesn't work.
Well, it doesn't. It clearly doesn't work. We're standing here today. You can see it clearly doesn't work. But moreover, the money that's gone in to do that, you know, that's costing money. And that's why I'm saying once again, if we had an overall strategy, then we can take smart action and not throw bad money after worse. And that's what we see here now today, which is really unfortunate.
Now, we'll come to the plan and what that might look like in a little while. But if you put rocks in down here to save some area of coast, that has a knock-on effect.
Yeah, that's right. So what happens, you have different mechanisms to mitigate against coastal erosion. And if you put in a hard face or a hard rock structure, like hard armour, what happens is that the wave comes in, it hits that armour and it deflects further down the coast.
It deflects sideways.
Precisely. So what happens is you might solve the problem right here and right now, but maybe 3 miles down the coast, all of a sudden the people start to recognise, God, I've never seen that happen here on our beach before. Okay. And that's why, again, this national strategy would, again, it would look at these type of situations and make sure that we plan properly for climate change.
What would that plan, that strategy look like, and how do we get to draw it up?
The most important thing for me at this stage is that we have local participation. So we need local knowledge, we need the stakeholders here from the tourist office, from all the different agencies, the fishermen, of course, and fisherwomen, and anyone involved in angling or whatever, all have to be part of a review mechanism to make sure that we come up with a good plan. And you know, sometimes we think we can't do things quickly. Well, just look at COVID-19, how quickly we were able to act as a nation. And when the word came out for us to take caution, we took caution and saved lives. Equally, on other things, we can get a move on and not be just kicking the can down the road again and again and again. We know climate change is happening. We know, as an island nation, that the coastal impacts will be huge, and it will have impacts on, as I said, the locals, the tourism, the housing. Coretown is just one example, but you'll find that this is happening in more places around the coast, and it really is time that we have a national strategy to deal with coastal erosion.
This happened here in Coretown very quickly, because last year it was a blue flag beach, and only this week the council pulled the blue flag because there's no more beach.
Yeah, that's a huge shame, you know, because, you know, communities, we love our blue flags. And it always, and it's a national story when a place loses its blue flag. And people feel bad. I think they genuinely feel bad, because to get the blue flag takes huge community effort, huge community, and the different agencies around the beach area and the local authority. To pull it is essentially saying we're failing, and that's a problem. And people won't come here, Fergal. When people see a blue flag, it's a guarantee of good water quality. It's a guarantee of generally a kind of a safeness in a beach area. You've got your lifeguards, you've got all the safety factors. When you pull the blue flag, it just means you've lowered your standard.
Is there anything that can be done here in Coretown quickly? The beach disappeared, I understand, over the course of a weekend.
Well, to be honest, Fergal, I'm not an engineer, so I cannot tell you that. But I'm sure if we were to look at countries like the Netherlands, like Denmark, places, other countries, and particularly the Netherlands, which has such a low-lying nation, that there are probably very, very good mechanisms that could be put in place. Because in a way, this is a local emergency now. So some kind of an emergency measure needs to be put in place.
One last question. Where did it go? Where did all the sand go?
Well, the sand went right back out to the sea. And you know what? It's going to move around now in the currents, and we can feel the wind above the water. But below the water, there are currents. And what's going to happen is all that sand is going to be taken and it's going to be deposited somewhere down along the coast. And you will hear fishermen or someone saying in the next few weeks, you know, that they hit a sandbank or something. But that sand isn't gone. It's just been displaced. And the problem we have now is where? And the problem also, Fergal, you could very well have nursery beds, mussel beds out there. What happens, they're filter feeders. So if you get a wash of sand back on top of the mussels, it'll literally just, it'll wipe them out for now, you know?
Thanks to Green MEP Grace O'Sullivan, who came to meet me on a very stormy evening in Corktown. Occasionally on the programme, we've been speaking about some of the famous ships of the world. Tonight, journalist John Litchfield, who's based in Paris, has a story of the most famous French ship of them all.
The last time I took part in this series, I spoke of the Dreadnought, a warship with a famous name which achieved little except to bring about a terrible war. My new subject is also a British warship, one with an Irish connection which was kept secret for 50 years. She was originally so obscure she had no name, just a code number, the HMS J826. She was a modest little vessel, only 140 feet and 360 tons, but she achieved great things, not warlike things, but peaceful, life-affirming things. She can justifiably take her place in our grand fleet of ships that changed the world. She still exists in bits in a Turkish shipyard. She still makes headlines when there is a new squall or change tack in what is now a 23-year-old struggle over her future. She's been declared part of French national heritage. One day, she may sail again. Never heard of her? Ah, you have. I'm sure you've heard of the Calypso, the ship that took the French undersea explorer Jacques Cousteau on his voyages to every ocean and most of the seas in the world from the 1950s to the 1990s. The ship which made cinematic and television history. The ship which helped to teach and enthrall the world about the richness and beauty hidden below the surface of the sea. Well, the Calypso was originally the HMS J826, a wooden-hulled minesweeper built on the west coast of the USA in Seattle in 1942. She was bought in 1949 by a Maltese ferry company, which renamed her Calypso after a sea nymph from Greek mythology. After a year, she was sold again to the Anglo-Irish millionaire and British MP Thomas Lowell Guinness, who planned to turn her and her sister minesweeper into luxury yachts. For a couple of months, Guinness changed his mind and leased the Calypso to the then unknown Jacques Cousteau, properly Jacques-Yves Cousteau, for one franc, about 2 shillings or 12 cents a year. Lowell Guinness made Cousteau agree to two conditions. The impecunious French inventor and sea explorer, already the co-inventor of the Aqualung, should never ask him for money, and he should never reveal who really owned the ship. The Guinness family connection was only revealed when Captain Cousteau died in 1997 at the age of 87. 1 year earlier, the Calypso, previously known as a lucky ship, had been rammed by a barge in Singapore Harbour. She sank, was salvaged, and brought back to France in a floating dry dock at huge expense. After the captain's death, the damaged ship was buffeted and almost wrecked by a tempestuous family quarrel. Who had the right to use the Cousteau name and who controlled the Calypso? Main contenders were Cousteau's widow and his former mistress, Francine, and his eldest son from his first marriage, Jean-Michel. Like a disputed orphan, the ship was installed in and ejected from a series of French ports and dockyards, Marseille, then La Rochelle, and then Concarneau in Brittany. All sorts of plans were made to restore her as an ocean-going vessel, as part of an ocean park at La Rochelle, or a floating museum on the French Mediterranean coast, or the centerpiece of an environmental theme park in the Caribbean. All the plans collapsed through lack of funds or because of the legal complexity of the ship's situation. Gradually, the little ship fell into ruins. I went to see her in La Rochelle on the French Bay of Biscay coast 16 years ago, hidden away under a tarpaulin in a corner of the harbour. I was astonished how small she was, no bigger than an average River Seine or Thames pleasure boat, much smaller than the grandest of the Bateau Mouche in Paris. By that time, she was in a lamentable condition. Everything that is not broken is rotten, and everything that is not rotten is broken, said Patrick Schnepp, director of the La Rochelle Maritime Museum. And as the Calypso slowly fell apart, so to an extent did the reputation of Captain Cousteau. It emerged that the sweet, nature-loving man in the red knitted cap held anti-Semitic views and that he had enjoyed friendly relations during the 1939-45 war with the occupying Germans and with the pro-Nazi Vichy regime. A book and a TV documentary claimed that Cousteau mistreated and even killed sea creatures while staging scenes for his films. His eldest son, Jean-Michel, his companion on many voyages before they fell out over the captain's second wife, confirmed the stories in a biography of his father a decade ago. We wouldn't consider it for a second now, but that's the way it was in the 60s and 70s, the younger Cousteau wrote. For him, the end sometimes justified the means. Isn't the important point that at the end of the day, he serves the cause of animals? Scenes in early Cousteau films were passed off as shot in the wild, but they used captive sea creatures, including dolphins and killer whales, which were goaded over and over to perform as the script required. It was not unusual for them to die during filming. That sank the captain's reputation as one of the fathers of environmentalism, a sort of French and maritime David Attenborough? Yes, in part, I suppose it did. But Cousteau's contribution to our understanding of the natural world was enormous, all the same. His TV series, The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau, is widely credited with helping to spawn the environmental movement by generating awareness of the fragility and diversity of living things. His eldest son insists that the captain's devotion to maritime life was sincere, but he held the old-fashioned view that it was the survival of species that counted, not the welfare of individual creatures. The younger Cousteau, despite his quarrel with his dad, claims, rightly I think, that the captain was one of the first ecologists in the modern sense. He awoke awareness of the dangers facing our planet. He was a precursor, long before others, of the concept of sustainable development. And all of that happened aboard a little wooden hulled minesweeper. Little Calypso at various points housed two mini submarines and a helicopter landing pad, as well as up to 27 crew. The wooden hull, originally designed to sweep up magnetic mines without setting them off, objected to all the weight of this equipment and became slightly warped. This kink was a feature of Calypso for many years before her sinking in 1996. Finally, after years of legal wrangling and complaints about unpaid repair bills, Calypso's fate was decided in a 2-year-long French lawsuit. Francine Cousteau won. The younger Lowell Guinness had already transferred ownership of the vessel to the Cousteau Society controlled by Francine. The price, €1. French government agreed to make the ship part of national heritage and provide some funds towards her restoration. She was, final in dignity, loaded aboard a giant freighter and shipped to Istanbul and to one of the few shipyards in the world which specialises in large wooden-hulled ships. But wait for it, the once lucky ship was ravaged by a fire in the Istanbul yard in September 2017. All of the new wooden hull was destroyed. The work resumed. A relaunch for early last year was announced. Date went by. The work continues. Sometime this year or next, we are now told the Calypso will sail again. How much of it will be the Calypso? It would have been possible to rebuild a replica for a fraction of what it's cost to house and move and now rebuild the original 1942 minesweeper. By all accounts, the Calypso, which emerges from the Istanbul yard, will be, in effect, a new ship, equipped with a few mementos from the original. The kink in the wooden hull has vanished. Will that make her a symbol of sustainability and conservation, or a symbol of stubbornness? Cousteau, who was not above a little trickery, would doubtless have approved. Just before his death, he declared his determination to bring back to life a ship which was my companion for the most wonderful 45 years of my life, a ship which risked typhoons and hurricanes, a ship which revealed to newcomers oceans of life.
And thanks to John Litchfield. A couple of weeks ago, we heard from Vera Quinlan on board the yacht Donu of Galway as they began their journey home to Ireland from the Caribbean. They are members of the Ocean Cruising Club, who've been helping yachts around the world to get to their home ports amid the pandemic. Daria Blackwell of the OCC told me about their work.
The Ocean Cruising Club is an organization of adventurous sailors who are all offshore sailors, basically. And it's based in the UK, but our membership is global. So we have about 3,500 members who are out cruising long distance, blue water, sailing across oceans much of the time.
These people are amateurs.
Yes, they're all amateurs. We do probably have a few professional sailors amongst the group, but they basically join because they also do cruising as a sideline.
Now, when the pandemic broke out, you had many members who were stranded in different parts of the world.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we have members who are stranded in Australia from Ireland, who were actually supposed to fly home for the summer and can't. So now we have other members who are stranded in Ireland who are taking care of their home and their dog and cat in exchange.
Really? Okay. So how did you go about planning to get people home? We had Vera Quinlan on the programme and their boat Danu of Galway, which is on its way home now. But how did you do the planning for them?
Well, there are a number of things that happened as the pandemic came about. We noticed very quickly that social media was the center of misinformation about what was happening out there. And as we watched boats take off from one place to another, and we saw borders closing behind them and ahead of them, and essentially stranding them at sea, we realized that we had to do something to reach out and help share reliable information. So what we did is we started to collect information from all our port officers around the world who support cruisers as they arrive in different countries. And we shared it with a website called Noonsight, which became the central repository of information that we had verified. And so we started by opening up our Facebook groups to non-members. And essentially, we provided people with the information to make their own decisions. But it did progress from there. And you mentioned the boat from Galway, Danu. They called us very early on to try to weigh what their options were. And essentially, their insurance told them that they couldn't go to Grenada, which was still open. They could have potentially hauled out in Antigua, but there were no flights out, so they would have been stuck there. And hurricane season was approaching, so their only chance to get out of the hurricane zone was to actually sail home earlier than expected. And so having gone through those decision-making processes, people were able to arrive at their own conclusion, and that eliminated a lot of fear and apprehension that people had about what the right thing to do was.
Because you were able to tell them what to expect if they arrived in somewhere like the halfway stop, the Azores or something like that.
Exactly. And our port officer in the Azores, José Azevedo, who is a wonderful man, he actually negotiated with the port authorities there to allow cruisers to at least come there and anchor, and he would provide provisions for them, and they would supply fuel and water so that at least people could get what they needed to make it the rest of the way home.
What's the progress of your fleet now, say those in the Caribbean?
Well, basically, they're strung all the way from the United States and Mexico to already having returned to Sweden and Norway and Spain. So we're stretched the entire way across the Atlantic, and we've got people in long-range radio communications from boats that are crossing and handing over as they reach the other side to other people who continue the communications. We also have a substantial portion of the fleet that has sat phones on board, and they're able to send in their coordinates daily so that a fleet tracker, which Predict Wind, a company in New Zealand, offered to set up for us for free, actually shows us where all the boats are along the Atlantic, and we can monitor if anybody gets into trouble. We can contact them and reach out and see if we can help.
And that tracker is available on your website?
Yes, it is.
You're happy with the way things are going and everybody's going to get home?
You know, we've had a number of instances of things going wrong, as you would expect. We've had two dismastings. We've had a rudder failure. We just had a boat that was about to reach its 1 millionth mile circulating the earth, and he was hit by lightning, and it's a steel boat. So there was a substantial amount of damage, but he's able to continue sailing, and he's now returning to Antigua. So basically, although we've had incidents, we've been able to coordinate rescue efforts, or at least stay on top of communications with these people, so if they need assistance, we can rally around them.
Daria Blackwell of the OCC, and their website is oceancruisingclub.org. If you ever dream of sailing in the Caribbean, maybe sometime you could charter a yacht there. Sail Cork has been doing online classes for the duration of the pandemic, and their final one next week is called Chartering in the Caribbean. You'll find details on sailcork.com.